Hello and welcome to the Thursday edition of the Soccer Central podcast. I'm John Molinaro, chief soccer reporter for Sportsnet.ca. I'm flying solo today as James Sharman is on assignment in Houston at the CONCACAF Women's Olympic Qualifiers. And speaking of the CONCACAF Qualifiers, Canada plays Costa Rica in the semifinals on Friday, a game that will determine who will go to this summer's Rio Olympics and who's going home. You can watch the game live on Sportsnet 1 at 5:15 Eastern. We're pleased to welcome to the Soccer Central podcast the man who will do the play-by-play for Friday's do-or-tie contest, Sportsnet commentator Jerry Dobson. Mr. Dobson, how are you, sir?
I'm just wonderful. How are you?
Good. Couldn't really ask for a better start, I guess, for Canada. Three decisive wins, top of the group, avoided the U.S. in the semis. Give us a recap of your thoughts. I mean, what have you made of the Canadian team's results and I guess more importantly, the performances in the group stage thus far?
Well, obviously, the performances speak for themselves. What is it, 22 goals scored, none conceded in three games? I think we have to put that into context, though, because when it comes to the women's game in CONCACAF, there's obviously a huge disparity between the top two countries, Canada and the United States, and everybody else. And we saw that. That was in evidence in the three qualifying games. Now, having said that, it seems as though over the last couple, 3 years, perhaps, a lot of the talk around the women's team has been, what's in store for the future of this team when that aging core of veterans finally calls it a day, led by, of course, Christine Sinclair? And if Christine Sinclair doesn't score goals, who's going to score for this team? And I think what we've seen during these three games is that there is some young, fresh blood coming into the team, some young players with a lot of talent and a lot of potential. And I think that's what I've seen from those three games anyway. Now, that will be tested a little bit more tomorrow night, and then certainly against the Americans, assuming they win tomorrow night, going into the final against the Americans. So I'll be interested to see that. But I think my takeaway is that there's some good young talent on this team, and I think John Herdman will be quite pleased to see that that's the case.
Well, and speaking of that young talent, who has stood out for you thus far? I mean, who's caught your eye?
Obviously, there's some young players that people know a little bit about, Ashley Lawrence and Rebecca Quinn, and some of these players have been around a little bit. The one that really has caught my attention is Michelle Prince. Mm. She's one of the youngest players and one of the newcomers, and she scored the hat trick the other day. And that one goal that she scored where she made a long run, maybe a 40-yard run down the left side, beat the defender because the defender actually had position on her. She beat her and then beat the goalkeeper with a shot from the outside of her right foot, picked the corner. To me, that was world-class stuff. I was quite amazed at that goal, and I think that's the kind of thing that we are hoping to see and have been hoping to see from some of the young offensive players, and she's one that has really impressed me.
Not so surprising that John Herdman rested a lot of his veterans in the last game against Guatemala. Canada had already qualified for the semis, so obviously he wanted to give some playing time to some of the youngsters, and he started quite a few. Is there danger, though, in that, just in the lack of continuity?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think that some of these parts have become almost interchangeable now. Left back, you can put Ashley Lawrence, or you can put Alicia Chapman, and I don't know if you gain a whole lot or lose a whole lot either way in situations like that or in positions like that. So I'm not too concerned about that. When you talk about these veteran players being rested and then they go back into a game, they've played so many matches together. A lot of these veteran players have received over 100 caps, more than 100 appearances playing for the national team, and with Sinclair, it's way more than that. So they're pretty used to each other, and I think they can probably go away for 3 months and come back and play together and not miss a beat. So I wouldn't be too concerned about that.
I mean, you alluded to it there early in one of your earlier answers. They've really cruised through this group stage. Not so surprising because of the quality gap, as you mentioned. But three wins, I think they outscored their opponents something like 22-0, and the last win was 10-0. So really haven't been tested in this tournament. Is that a negative or a positive? Could that potentially come back to hurt them against Costa Rica?
You know, you might say yes, but I think in the women's game, we've come to expect that kind of thing. And I think they're no fools. They realize that as well. They know that they've been playing inferior opposition and that it's going to get tougher against Costa Rica, although it's still a team they should beat. I don't think there's any doubt about that. They should beat them and beat them handily. It's the game against the U.S. is always the big test, of course. But I don't think there's any danger in the team getting overconfident or looking beyond they know that there are some soft touches in CONCACAF, and they know that ultimately they'll face some difficult challenges, and I think mentally they're prepared for that. I think it was 21-0, right? 6-5 is 11, and then 10 is 21-0.
Right.
Who's quibbling over a goal when it gets into those numbers, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But I don't think there's any concern about being overconfident or not being tested. They know what's down the road.
Yeah, and we talked earlier about sort of working the young players into the roster, not just for this tournament, because obviously John wants to build the program for not only for the Olympics, but for the long term. Do you like how he's done it? Do you like how he's kind of managed their minutes and his game management in terms of working the young players in?
Yeah, I do. I like it a lot in terms of what he's done, because he'll take a player, a young player, and not play them, then put them and start them the next game, but maybe only play them an hour and bring them off and put somebody else on, a veteran player. I like what he's done there, and I think it's a good way to gently ease some of these players in. And he's doing it, and he's afforded the luxury of being able to do it in tournaments like this where there is some softer opposition, so they're not thrown right into the fire and facing all kinds of pressure. When you play a game like they did the other night against Guatemala and win rather easily, 10-0, that's a great opportunity to put in young players and allow them to build their confidence and score some goals. And I think it just develops them that much better.
Right. One of the young players that everyone is sort of talking about with the Canadian program is Kadisha Buchanan, the young defender from Brampton, Ontario, who today was named to the inaugural FIFA Pro Women's World Starting 11, as voted by female players around the world. Quite an amazing story for her. I mean, what have you made of her progress and development since she made her senior team debut? Because she's really come along in a very short period of time, hasn't she?
She has. I mean, we saw her, I think it was a couple of years ago, a game in Winnipeg against the United States.
Right.
A game in BMO Field as well. But she showed, what she showed to me then was flashes of brilliance and also, how to put it in a positive way, there were some negative things to her game, obviously, because of her. She was so raw and so inexperienced. But she has developed so much because the talent is there, and now she's starting to eliminate the mistakes, the mental mistakes, the positional mistakes, those kinds of things. And so I think she belongs where FIFA has placed her, and I think that it's great for the future.
And she's still a young woman, I think 21 or 22, but, I mean, from watching her play, and center back, it's a tough position. I mean, and it's an important position as well, not that they're all important positions, but especially center back. And for someone of that age, she plays with such sort of poise and maturity, almost as a veteran. Would you not agree?
I would agree, for sure. I think that it's remarkable where she is for her age, and I think that bodes well for the future. And if you can have the spine of a team that Canada has now, Aaron McLeod still has plenty of years left in goal, and you have likes of Kadisha Buchanan and some of the others emerging in the center of defense and then up through the midfield and right up to the striker position where we're seeing some fine young players now. It looks as though the future, in my opinion, the future is much brighter than I thought it would have been a couple of years ago.
Right. And further to the future, because as we talked about earlier, the problem with Canada or the sort of criticism has always been, well, who else but Christine is going to score the goals? But it seemed like Prince has stepped up and Janine Becky and Jesse Fleming, and there's been well-rounded scoring, well-balanced scoring at this tournament. Does it give you... I don't know. What do you think of the team's attacking sort of options going forward in the future?
Oh, I think that's the best part of what we've seen so far in this tournament. Again, we have to temper our enthusiasm, I guess, because the opposition has been so inferior, but you can't
Sure.
deny the class that we've seen. And I think that the attacking options take so much pressure off Sinclair, because let's face it, she knew as well as we did that if she didn't score the goals, nobody else was going to score them. So there was so much pressure on her to perform game in and game out. Well, I think now we're seeing that she doesn't have to carry the team on her back. There are other players who can step up, other players with some talent that can finish chances and beat defenders one-on-one. So it's not all about her, and I think that will make it easier for her to do what she needs to do.
I think it's important to remind listeners that this game on Friday, it's do or die. So win and they're in the Olympics, and lose and they're out. So there's no sort of margin for error here.
It's a funny one, isn't it? Because you think, well, you got to get to the final if you're going to go anywhere, but not in this kind of a tournament. Just win your semifinal and you're in. The final becomes anticlimactic, really.
Yes.
All you got to do is win your semifinal. So, but if you lose the semifinal, you're right, you're done. So.
And
perform tomorrow night.
And so obviously it's a pressure situation on Friday. I mean, the team obviously would like to qualify for the Olympics. How important is it for the program to do that, to go to Rio?
Oh, I think it's pretty important. I mean, we saw what happened in London 4 years ago and the story that that developed out of that. And I think for Canada, for Canada's women's team not to be at the Olympics, I think would be a major blow to the program. I think that it's something that everybody fully expects. I think it's something that you need to have happen in order to keep the momentum up, to keep the focus on the women's team, and to keep the, you know, the sponsorship still coming and the attention on that team. I think they have to get to the Olympics, and I think they will.
Mm. Costa Rica, no soft touch compared to their group stage opponents. This is a team that's, I think their program has quite improved quite a bit over the last few years, and they were at the Women's World Cup last year. What's your take on them?
Well, they did perform well at the Women's World Cup, and I think it's always been kind of considered that in CONCACAF, you know, Canada and the United States are on a separate level, and then in behind would be Mexico and then pretty much everybody else.
Right.
Costa Rica just beat Mexico, and that's why Canada is playing that. Mexico will not have even a shot at getting to the Olympics. And so for Costa Rica to beat Mexico, that tells you that they're a better side right now than perhaps they've ever been. And so, you know, it might be a tricky one for Canada. I'm pretty confident they'll still be able to handle them. I think they have developed a long way, or come a long way, in their development of the women's program. And so it's good to see, because you want to see more quality teams in CONCACAF. It's good for the game, and it's good for Canada to have to play teams of tougher opposition. But I think that they are probably the third-ranked team in CONCACAF now, and probably should be based on the results we've seen.
So how does Canada match up against Costa Rica? What kind of match can we expect on Friday, do you think?
Oh, I think Canada will go at them. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I think John Herdman is confident of all the options that he has attacking, and so I think Canada will try and take the game to them. And I think Costa Rica expect that and will probably be just trying to you know, put as many people behind the ball as they can and hopefully get an opportunity on a counterattack. But I think Canada should be able to overwhelm them and put a few balls in the back of the net and win.
Right. As I mentioned, you're going to be calling the game for Sportsnet 1, and Karina LeBlanc, former Canadian international goalkeeper who retired after the Women's World Cup last year, is going to be doing color commentating with you. Looking forward to working with Karina?
I am indeed. I mean, I've got to know Karina as a person over the years. I've never worked with her, per se, in television, but she's a great person, a great personality, a great character. She knows the game inside out due to her lengthy career playing with the national team in the program. And so I've watched what she has done with the group stage games streamed by CBC, and she brings a lot to the table, and I'm really looking forward to working with her.
Well, it should be a good broadcast and hopefully a good game and hopefully a Canadian win. Listen, Jerry, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it, and enjoy the game on Friday.
You bet. Thanks a lot, John. Take care.
No worries. That was Jerry Dobson, Sportsnet commentator, who's going to be calling the game on Friday. And just a reminder that you can watch that Canada versus Costa Rica game in the semifinals of the CONCACAF Women's Olympic Qualifiers live on Sportsnet 1 starting at 5:15 Eastern. If Canada wins, it qualifies for the Rio Olympics this summer. A loss eliminates them, so this is a huge game for Canada. And as mentioned, Jerry Dobson and former Canadian international Karina LeBlanc will have the call, so be sure to tune in. It's the second half of the Soccer Central podcast, and we thought we'd try something different here. Regular listeners of the show know we usually talk to soccer journalists and broadcasters from around the world, such as Sid Lowe and Paolo Bandini of The Guardian, Matt Spiro from BN Sports in Paris, and Patty Agnew in Rome. I thought it might be interesting to talk to someone who works in media but who doesn't cover soccer, but is nonetheless a fan of the sport, and talk to them about their passion for the game. And with that, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show Michael Corrin. Michael is an esteemed and leading broadcaster, reporter, and writer who covers Canadian politics and social issues for a variety of publications and radio and TV stations. He's also the author of several books, including his latest entitled Epiphany, Christian's Change of Heart and Mind Over Same-Sex Marriage, which will come out later this year. Aside from that, though, he's also a big soccer fan, having grown up in England before moving to Canada in the 1980s. Michael is a diehard Tottenham fan, and he's been kind enough to take time out of his very busy schedule to join the Soccer Central podcast to talk about his love of Spurs. Mr. Corrin, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much indeed.
Now, this should be interesting because, as people know, Arsenal is my English team, so I suspect there's going to be a fair bit of banter between us in this segment.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I mean, often childhood trauma does lead or, you know, maybe a car collision leads to the support for Arsenal, which is unfortunate. But I, as a Christian, I try to evince pity rather than contempt for those who are thus unfortunate.
Oh, I see. Interesting. And can you remind me when was the last thing that you guys have won of any substance? It was the League Cup, right? Which I was surprised they even still played that, to be honest.
Yeah. Oh, no, you're quite right. If you have enough money and enough wealth.
Oh, here we go.
And then you can do quite well. But no, look, in all reality, look, I was born in Walthamstow. And you have to be a Tottenham. My dad, God rest his soul, was from Tottenham. I mean, he and my uncle played for Spurs Juniors and was actually offered a contract by Norwich City when they, this will date you, update them, when they win Third Division South.
Oh, wow.
And he was in the RAF station in Norfolk, and they saw him playing, and they offered him a contract, and he turned them down, believe it or not. But, I mean, I started going to White Hart Lane with my dad when I was 5 years old, and it's not, look, believe me, there have been times in my life when I wish my father wasn't raised in Tottenham and Hackney and was raised maybe in Finsbury Park, and I was an Arsenal fan. And in fact, we have four kids, and I mean, the girls couldn't care less, but the boys are one boy is fairly passionate. One boy is a huge fan. He actually is very good. He was with the youth systems in Blackburn and Wycombe Wanderers for a few years. But I remember I took him to see Spurs play Middlesbrough years ago, and on the way back from the pub, that's how long ago it was, you had to go to a pub to see a game. He said, Dad, do I have to be a Tottenham fan? And I said, no, you can't. But you can't support Arsenal or Chelsea. And he said, no. So it's been tough, but you know what it's like. It's tribal. It's visceral. I am a Tottenham fan. Sure. And you know, we haven't won the league since 1961. We've won the Cup a few times. We did well in the Champions League. We haven't had the money or the glamour to hold on to our best players. That's happened half a dozen times. But this year, I have to say, and I've watched Tottenham for, I'm 57. I mean, I've been a fan for, you know, well, 50 years. And here's the paradox. It's not a typical Tottenham team.
No, it's not.
It's a very unusual team for Spurs. And if we may win the league. We may not. I mean, I don't know. I mean, who would have thought that Leicester City would be, we thought they'd be fighting at the other end of the table. But we are as good, I will say this, we are as good as any other team in the league. We've got the best goal difference, which is incredible because in the past, even when we finished fourth, we've had a bad goal difference. We've got possibly the youngest team in world-class football at the moment. And we're about to build a stadium or enlarge the stadium that'll make us seriously big because 34,500, you can't even get a ticket. So I think we're looking at the next 5 years as a period when there'll be two major teams. Well, actually, maybe just two major teams in London because Chelsea have to do something radical. This is not a blip.
No.
They have to completely rethink the way they play. They've relied solely on money up to now. And by the way, I've got to tell you this, I hate Chelsea way more than I hate Arsenal.
Oh, fair enough. So I'm interested, just kind of circling back to your genesis, for lack of a better word, as a Spurs fan. It sounds like your dad was an influential figure in your becoming Spurs. Maybe you can just kind of share a little bit more about how the bond between you and him in football.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get sort of too esoteric about this, but there's an interesting urban sociology about football. I mean, Tottenham are known, and many of the listeners might realize this, are known as a Jewish team.
Right.
Actually, I'm just writing a big piece for a newspaper about this very subject. It's very multi-layered. Many countries have a team that's thought to be a Jewish team. There's even one in Argentina. They're known as the Russians, actually, and they don't play in the senior level. But Ajax have this reputation.
Yep.
And I mean, it's replicated in many European countries. With Tottenham, the area of London it's in, there's a Jewish, my father was Jewish, my mother wasn't. But actually, Arsenal have just as many, maybe even more Jewish fans than Tottenham. It's a very similar support. But this is largely connected with a TV show called To Death Us Do Part. It's all way too inside baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But they're known as that, and they were abused, particularly by Chelsea, because of it. So they then owned the name. And I mean, I'm not going to say it on a podcast, but we have a nickname, which is an offensive word for Jewish people, but we sure. chant it. We own it. It's a bit like the N-word. You take ownership of it. And so ethnic background, working class background, the bond with my father. I mean, he was a cab driver in London. He would I sit in the front of the cab where the luggage was meant to go. You weren't allowed to, it was illegal, but the law was a bit more fluid in those days. You know, you drive to White Hart Lane, and so when at the age of 4 or 5, you're taken in there and you see the green, how green it is, and particularly evening games, the floodlights, and in those days, I mean, the white shirts, you couldn't buy a Tottenham kit when I was growing up. It's not like today, where everyone has to. I remember my mum sewing on a Cockerill badge, this white shirt, and you could never find the exact blue shorts that they wore. Mm. You could get sky blue or black, but you couldn't quite get the Tottenham blue. It was very hard. But it was, and I went to a school that was overwhelmingly West Ham. I grew up in northeast London, Essex, and most of the kids there were West Ham fans. So the real the enemy for me was West Ham, but later on it became Chelsea because, with all due respect, and most Chelsea fans are lovely, but when I was growing up, if you were on the far right, if you were a fascist anywhere in London, you were a Chelsea fan. Now, that was a small minority of their support, but believe me, that is what happened. And even now, even though they have a Russian Jewish owner and so on, and they've had Israeli players in the team, there is still a very small element of that left at Chelsea. And when Chelsea plays Spurs, that's when it really does come out.
Interesting. Very interesting. Did you go to White Hart Lane growing up? I mean, any favorite memories of, visiting the stadium and going to a game?
I went all the time. I went with my dad till I was about 11 or 12. And then I went with my mates kind of Park Lane.
Mm.
You know, I remember when I said to my dad, "Dad, I want to go with my friends now, not with you." And I think it was probably quite hard for him. You never understand what it's like to be a father until you're a father.
Sure.
I think the smell, I mean, I don't know, it's hard to describe it. I think it's a smell of sort of tobacco and chocolate and the field. I don't, that was the experience. In those days, I mean, Tottenham, they've always been a big team. And in those days, we'd win almost every home game and about 5 away games and finish, you know, high up but not good enough. What do I remember? I remember when I was older on my own, watching them beat Bristol Rovers 9-0. I think it was 9-0. And it was boring. That was the year we were relegated for 1 year. In my lifetime, it's only happened once. And, games like that. And the Arsenal games. I mean, it's the only time I ever got in trouble with the police.
Oh, wow. There's an interesting story there, I'm sure.
Well, I was always way too cowardly to, you know, be a real tough guy. But, you know, kids dressed in a certain way, and I was just caught in a crowd, and there was some pushing. And I remember a cop picked me up by my neck, so I was effectively hanging. And I had red hair in those days, and he said, "Come here, ginger." No, I've got no hair at all, and pushed me into. But it was when we won the UEFA Cup, we beat Wolves. I went up to Molineux to Wolverhampton for the first leg and the second leg at Spurs. And when we won it, I ran on the pitch. It's the only time I've ever run on the pitch.
Wow.
And that was, that was great. That was wonderful. And so lots of memories, lots of very fond memories. Mm.
Some very talented players have played for Spurs over the years. Glenn Hoddle and Ozzie Ardiles and Ricky Villa, all the way to, you know, Gareth Bale and the current crop. Who have you enjoyed watching, both when you were going to White Hart Lane and now as you watch abroad?
Well, I think a lot of what forms you is when you're quite young. So I still think back to the teams that I watch almost every single week. And, you know, players like the goalkeeper, Pat Jennings,
right,
who started pretty much when I began to go. It was when Bill Brown was ending his career. Actually, Bill Brown came to Canada. I think he lived in Dundas, Ontario.
Hmm.
But Martin Chivers, I saw the tail end of Jimmy Greaves' career. Alan Gilzean was a wonderful player. Alan Mallory was a marvelous player to watch. And then later on, I mean, Glenn Hoddle, who, he really was a player who was not appreciated in England.
I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. And the England team, I mean, this is the frustration of being English. It might change now. And by the way, Spurs might have half the England team at this point. Which is really very interesting. Some wonderful young English players. But Hoddle and when Chris Waddle was with him, Gary Lineker, and of course Paul Gascoigne. I met Paul Gascoigne very briefly at a hotel a couple of years ago when I was staying in London, and because there was something, I mean, he's such a broken, vulnerable character, but at the same time, he had such an innocence and a skill about him. So I mean, loads. And Gareth, I mean, I'll admit it. I mean, I cried watching Gareth Bale. they were, you know, he was so good. That's what I dislike about football today. That, and it's going to happen. Look, try being a Southampton fan. You produce brilliant player after brilliant player, and you know they're going to go. You simply, even though you might finish fifth or sixth, you can't. Or, and your manager, by the way, we got him. But it was obvious Bale was going to go, and that was very sad. And now with Harry Kane, see, this is where it's different now. Not only, you know, he's one of us, but now you have a team. Look, I don't think anyone would say we're not going to make the Champions League. That would be extraordinary if we didn't do that. We might not win the league, but we're, you know, 10 points ahead of Man United, and they're not looking very good. I think now we can hold on to these players, and particularly with the new stadium. So
and the new TV deal as well, because that's going to be a flush of new cash. So, I mean, not to cut you off, but I tend to think that maybe clubs like Spurs and even Leicester, they're going to be able to hold on to these players a little bit longer, not necessarily being selling teams. Do you know what I mean?
I certainly think with Tottenham, I mean, I don't know about Leicester. You know, it is incredible. And, you know, you're a far more expert than me in this, but it's very hard to quantify, actually, why Leicester are doing so well. Because before the season started, if you looked at all their players, very few of them would have made the starting lineup for the top half a dozen teams, frankly. Maybe one or two, but most. I mean, they have players who Spurs have rejected over the years, almost laughingly. We wouldn't want them. I don't know. Do you remember when Blackburn, they won the league, and they did very badly in Europe, and it started a decline and a demise? There's a problem of how much money will really be around, and can they keep those players? And I think Europe, Leicester again, will be in the Champions League almost certainly, and will they be able to maintain that? Wait till they have to start travelling. I mean, if you look at how much travelling the top four teams are doing in February, and Spurs are travelling about 2,000 miles or something, and Leicester are travelling no miles at all. I mean, they're at home, I think, the whole time, and they're not in Europe. And so once they're playing in other competitions and so on, we'll see what happens.
Right. When you moved to Canada in the 80s, you were coming to a country that essentially had no real culture of the game. I mean, compared to where you were coming from. Yeah. How hard was it for you to follow Spurs and keep tabs on them?
Well, I think I went through a period of not caring as much, to be honest.
Okay.
I mean, there was a period of decline for me. When I went to university, and I did my BA at Nottingham University, and at that time, that was 77 to 80. Now, that was when Brian Clough's Nottingham Forest were, I suppose, the best team in the world. And it's the smallest city to ever have won the Champions, or what was then called the European Cup. So I used to go and watch Forest quite a bit. I was still a Tottenham fan, but so there was that. And then when I came to Canada, I let it slide. I mean, I was still a Tottenham fan. It was hard to get them on TV, so you'd often go to the pub to watch the games. And they went through a bad time. It was just, you knew they weren't competing. And I've always been a Spurs fan, but I visit Britain frequently. I mean, one of my other loves is Colchester United, not in the same way, but I'm from Essex, and they're having a terrible season. I think they'll be relegated. But, you know, the last couple of times I've been, it was so much money to get a ticket for Tottenham because you couldn't go and buy one through the standard form. You had to buy one from a scalper, from a spiv, from a whatever. Then I've gone to see Colchester play. So I haven't seen Tottenham live in a couple of years now. I saw them play Arsenal and a couple of other games. But no, it was very difficult. I mean, I think kids today don't realize in Canada just how it's been transformed by people like yourself and James and others in the past 10 years.
Well, and I wanted to talk to you about that. I mean, what have you made of the growth of the interest of the game here in Canada?
Well, I love it. I absolutely love it. I tried to get into hockey when I married a Canadian, came here. I've been here 28 years. I've been here half my life. I don't enjoy hockey. I didn't grow up with it. I don't skate. I don't know the history, and I try, but I'm not going to pretend. My passions are rugby and football. But I think it's wonderful how it's really grown. And it's not just ethnic communities, you know, English or Italian or Portuguese or Croatian. So I love the sport. It doesn't require any money. It's why, I mean, the great sport of black people in South Africa was football, was soccer. Rugby was the Afrikaners, cricket was the English, but soccer, it was, in Latin America, the game of the poor.
Right.
All you need is a ball. I mean, in the Charlton brothers in England, you know, rolled up lumps of paper, and I don't want to romanticize it too much, but anyone can play. And if you look at the composition of teams, look at the racial composition. I mean, everyone plays it. Everyone plays it.
Right.
There are sports in North America that are dominated by particular groups, and I don't think that's desirable. I've seen with my kids playing football, playing soccer, such a breakdown of barriers, and in every way it's become more progressive. And when I was growing up, it was quite dour. I mean, Rodney Marsh, the English player, he was a very good player, played for QPR and Manchester City in England. He once said that football in England was a grey game watched by grey people on grey days. And, you know, you went and you couldn't buy anything to eat, maybe a cup of Bovril. People won't even know what that is. And and there was violence, and women just didn't go.
Right.
And it's all changed now. And some ways for the worse. It is too commercialized, but that's inevitable. But I think it's wonderful what's happened now in Canada. But what we have to do is change some of the coaching, because I've seen it with my younger son in particular. There's some very good coaching, but there are other coaches who don't really understand the game, and they think lots of sort of individual skill, which is a good thing, it's a great thing, but that's all that matters, when in fact the ability to read a game and to make a penetrating pass and to break open the defense is much more significant than looking really impressive and clever with a ball when there's no one around you. And I think there are some problems at certain age groups. Kids who are up to a certain age are really good, and then they lack the development at a certain point. But we can compete. As I said, when my son was in England, most of the stuff he was doing was in League One and League Two, but they're still very good players.
Mm-hmm.
But he was competing. There was very little difference. I mean, Canada can be a great soccer nation. I also think, and I don't say this with any relish, but I think the U.S. will probably win the World Cup within my lifetime.
Before we do, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. Circling back to Spurs, a big win away to Man City last week, tied for second with Arsenal and just 2 points off the pace of leaders Leicester. Have you allowed yourself to believe that winning the Premier League is a distinct possibility here?
Recently. Until recently. You know, being a Spurs fan, there's a sense of humor at Tottenham. I mean, it's sort of, yeah, whatever. I thought the bubble was going to burst. And at the beginning of the season, I was a bit pessimistic. I didn't think we'd developed in any way. But we really have. And there's a level of fitness and youth. And we seem to have players at every position who really are outstanding. And they're developing as well. And the relationship, I mean, you saw what happened at the end of the game, and I was genuinely moved by it, where you had the team going over to our fans at the end,
right,
and Harry Kane actually running over and pointing at people, and the manager hugging everyone. I mean, that's really important. There are no prima donnas. I know Harry Kane is thought to be the great player, but we have a lot of great players. And it's a multiracial team, but there does seem to be a bond there. And there were complaints, why weren't we buying more players? Well, we need another striker, and I think we'll probably buy a world-class striker for next season. But who are you going to replace? You know, there are times when Kyle Walker drives me crazy. He's a brilliant player, but almost every game he'll do something that he's really stupid, and you go crazy, but he's a great player. And all through the team, we don't, there's a couple of injuries that have hurt us, but we don't really have weak points. And the manager's also given time to players who I think under other managers would have been let go,
mm-hmm,
because they weren't making it at that point. And he inherited a disaster because with the money from Gareth Bale, it's not that we bought some good players, but more than half, the majority of the players we bought with that money weren't up to it.
But what we have now, yeah, we can. I mean, it's... Look, I think it's going to be between Spurs and Arsenal, frankly. I think Leicester are going to lose a couple of games. And I don't know, it's just visceral, but I just believe they are. I think it could be between Spurs and Arsenal. Our goal difference, we don't let in goals, and we do score, and it looks like we'll keep our goal difference superiority, and it will be really amazing if we won the league on goal difference above Arsenal.
Yeah, it would be amazing. Surely, I mean, you know, it's been, I mean, regardless of what happens, it's been a sensational season for Spurs. But surely, as an Englishman, it must burn you to no end that an Argentine is leading you to glory. With tongue in cheek.
It really does. Actually, we've had a relationship with Argentina, of course.
Sure.
I mean, the Falklands War took two great players out of our team, which was tragic, as was the war, shouldn't it? Now, Borges, the great author, said it was like two bald men fighting over a comb. And but you know, when a fascist dictatorship invade, I mean, what are you going to do? I won't go on about that, but the personal fault there was Margaret Thatcher, because she removed the naval patrol the Labour government had left in there,
right,
that made the Argentinians realize, don't go in. However, no, it doesn't. And it's inevitable now. And, I mean, in that so many managers are Scottish, I'd rather have an Argentinian there than a Scottish.
Well, that's quite the indictment.
No, I'm teasing. I don't think it matters. And anyway, it will be a redundant complaint, because this is the nature of modern football. I mean, these teams are, you know, look, when Celtic won the European Cup in, 67, every player in the team had been born within like a 30-mile radius or closer of the stadium. And there is something wonderful about that. And there's a romance about having local players. We do have some local players, though. We have players that came up through our youth system or have been with the club for a long time. David Beckham was effectively a Tottenham boy. His dad was a Tottenham fan. He wanted to play for Man United. I think faithfulness to the club and what it represents is what matters now. But, of course, it changes international football, because now when nations play each other,
sure,
there are guys who have spent all their time with people they're playing against. So it's changed the whole international scene.
We've got to go, Michael. But before you do, kind of an overreaching question, and I kind of ask this of almost of everyone comes on. Why does football matter? I mean, there's so many options out there to sort of dedicate your sporting allegiance to. Why football? Why does this game capture our imagination so?
Well, I don't know who it was, but someone described it as the ballet of the working man. And I do think there is something wonderfully working class about it. And as a product of a working class home, I've always thought that very much. And I don't want it to become too embourgeoised. I certainly don't want it to become the... And although it's nice when celebrities say they enjoy football, it must remain what ordinary people love. And you know, rugby, for example, I love rugby, but rugby is really the game of the middle class in England. Mm. Football's always been there. You look at these photos of years ago, 80,000, mainly guys, in cloth caps, you know, smoking their pipes, and the history of losing people during war, and so it matters. It's a good question. Should it matter? I don't know.
Mm.
Does it matter? Yes. Historically in England, men would work 6-day weeks often. They would take any time they could to go and watch their team play. And I remember when Ipswich Town did very well for years and won the top teams, and a local employer would say the productivity on a Monday morning would go up if Ipswich had won and go down if it lost. And it is a tribe. I'll say this, I'll just conclude. I hate it when people talk about the franchise. I hate it. This is not a franchise. And there's someone I used to work with, and I would always say, we did well, when I would speak of Tottenham. And he would think this was so... He's an idiot, frankly. But he would say, who are we? Were you playing? And I wanted to just, you know, punch him in the face. But he didn't get it.
Right.
I wasn't being pretentious.
No.
We think of it in the collective.
Sure.
It's we. And it does make it different from a lot of North American sports. I never, ever obviously condone violence, but I did sometimes understand it. People became very, very passionate. And of course, that must never be allowed to turn itself into violence. But you do feel something in the gut and the heart. And look, if Tottenham won the league, I would cry like a baby. I would. I mean, I would cry that my dad couldn't see it.
Right.
I think he went to every single game in 1961. I'd cry because if it does get that close, I might even just, sell one of the kids and get a ticket and go to England. But it would mean a great deal to me. Yeah, it would be wonderful.
Right. Listen, Michael, brilliant for you to take time out of your busy schedule to talk to us. We really appreciate it. Best of luck with the new book, and go Gunners.
Thanks, Rich. Thanks.
Cheers. That was Michael Corrin, a Canadian broadcaster and reporter, kind enough to join us on the Soccer Central podcast. That's it for another edition of the podcast. It's in the books. My thanks to Brent Gunning, the man behind the glass who produces the show, and to our guests Michael Corrin and Jerry Dobson. Just a reminder, you can watch the Canada versus Costa Rica Women's Olympic Qualifier live on Sportsnet 1 at 5:15 Eastern on Friday. You can also watch games from the fifth round of the FA Cup and the German Bundesliga this weekend on Sportsnet. Go to sportsnet.ca and consult the broadcast schedule for match listings. Thomas Dobby and Brennan Dunlop will be back with another edition of the Soccer Central podcast on Monday morning. Until then, cheers for listening.